Today is Monday, March 27th, 2023. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spelled his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Oh, that's great. I'm happy to be here with you. And
super.
I'm looking forward to all this.
Oh, good.
It's fun to take me back in time.
Great. Scott, would you allow us to record this oral history over the telephone today?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. We left off last time on your first run of the Selway, an afterthought almost, that river trip. Could you pick that story up for us, please?
Sure. We went to the Selway because the middle fork of the Salmon was flooding, which was a terrible decision, but nobody in the office or none of the guides knew quite what we were getting into. But if you got the middle fork flooding, the Selway's flooding as well. And the bus with all the passengers were already headed over to the Selway. And so we were all blind to what we were getting into. And we ended up taking the vehicles and all the gear over to the Selway put in and getting the people on and heading on down this flooding, cold, ice cold, snow on the ground Selway.
And you covered that really, really well up
through
the last rapid, I think, and then the sun came out and it was warm and the wind wasn't blowing.
Yeah. Now, I don't remember that so much, but of course the river was just frothingly huge, and we knew Wolf Creek was coming up, and again it was just another rapid that we had no idea what we were getting into.
Okay.
Everything was run blind, and we got to Wolf Creek, and it wasn't too bad. It was big, a lot of flooding water, but we managed to scoot to the left side of it somehow. I think there's a wall at Wolf Creek that you don't want to get close to, and it's pretty gnarly there. So we had a good spot that we picked as we rode into it, and then after that, it's pretty much a cruise down to the takeout spot, which has got, as I recollect, there might be picnic benches and stuff there. It's the first piece of civilization that we had seen, and we pulled our boats in, and we were really thankful that we had survived. And all the guides that ran on that trip really felt relief when we finally got to shore, tied the boats off, and said, wow, that's it. We did it. We did the Selway in flood. And we all admitted to each other that we would never, ever do that trip again, at least in those conditions, in 7 foot levels of water in the practically wintertime. It was just post-winter. It was early June. And every time you worked out in that Montana, Idaho area, June was a cold, snowy time. You never knew what kind of storms you'd get, but it was really always cold until you started moving into July, maybe a little bit farther into the year.
Okay.
But anyway, we got to the takeout. We got our boats tied off, and we went up eventually and found a cafe somewhere. I don't recollect, but we all sat down and ate. And then we just talked about what we'd been through and looked at each other. And are you guys, to the number, not willing to do this again? I want to know what everybody feels about what we just went through and how safe it is to do. And everybody to the man said, no, we're not going through that again. That we are lucky to be alive, that we made it through in our little boats. And so that was the consensus, and I agreed with that. I go, this is crazy. We're way out of our league with our boats and the size of water down there.
Okay.
And so that's pretty much where that particular very first Arda trip on the Selway, that was the first of that of Arda's trips. Unscheduled, and then they followed up the next year, if you want me to get into this part of the next Selway trip.
Well, so let's finish off this year first.
Okay.
After that Selway trip, then did you get back on some more Middle Fork or Maine trips that summer?
Oh, yeah. So, Yeah, that ended, and so I still had Middle Fork trips to go through.
Okay.
So, because this is right in the beginning of the whole season, and we should have never been on the Selway. We would have been on the Middle Fork if we were allowed to go on that flooding place, which we were sort of used to flooding Middle Forks. But so by the time we finished the Selway, we went back to our KOA camp in North Fork, Idaho. And that's where we staged everything out of. And it was pretty much, we've got a trip coming up in, you know, a few days. We got to go buy food. We got to make sure we've got gear to go out. And so then the whole Middle Fork season started. And that went until whenever, October or something like that. And
I'm assuming that first Middle Fork trip just, you know, sounds like within 5 days or so of the Selway trip, the water would have still been pretty high on the Middle Fork.
I don't recollect anything scary, but like I had said priorly, that in another moment that we were asked to go down and pick up a fellow's gear that had drowned down there, and they wrecked it. I think it was on a dory trip, not a Grand Canyon dory, but the drift boat trips with Prince Helfrich, I think was the trip.
Hmm.
And anyway, so we had seen flooding high water for the Middle Fork in horrible conditions, rain, cold, and big water, muddy logs, everything. So when we got back from the Selway and we started our season on the Middle Fork, that was kind of like, you know, just easy. I was like nothing. And all of us, by that time, from Middle Fork seasons and then the Selway stuff, we'd seen big water. We'd seen flood water, and we had negotiated lots of mountain boulders. You know, the mountain river trips are full of, you know, different calamities in the Grand Canyon. So there's lots of learning how to row your boat through rock gardens and what to look for and how to read water. So all of us were very seasoned in, you know, knowing what to do in all these various conditions. So going back to the Middle Fork, it was pretty much what maybe a normal regular season would be like. So when we got from Selway back over to there, we got our stuff rigged up and everything set to go, and off we would go to the Middle Fork, Stanley, and off to the Middle Fork.
Okay.
And that's where the season finished, was out in October sometime. We finished all the Middle Fork stuff. And
okay.
And so then at that point, another little story starts with me getting to, well, no, then the next one is up to the Selway, where, if you want me to go into this right now.
I do, but the second Selway trip is going to be in the spring of, I'm thinking, the next year. Is that right?
It's the next year.
Yeah.
The next year.
What did you do that winter? It's October. Did you head back to home in California, back to Sacramento?
Yeah, so I went back to Sacramento, and I was collecting unemployment insurance and so forth, and I'd saved all my earnings from the prior season. And I wanted to go spend the year in Europe and travel with a backpack. So when I finished the Middle Fork season, I went home and I kind of got stuff organized at my family's home. And I got the gear I needed to travel and get an air flight over to London, and so I spent that winter backpacking and hitchhiking through Europe.
Wow, wait, Scott, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, that was a very common thing at the time. This is just past the 60s. In the 70s, we talked about before, we're very near like the 60s. It wasn't like you leaped several decades ahead. But so it was just like, gosh, I'm going to go over there. Oh, and what had happened to me is that when I finished high school, I got on a program for 3 months to go to a university in France, at Dijon, France.
Ah.
And so I went and did all of that and got a good feel for what Europe was like.
Cool.
In a more of a controlled situation, where I was staying at a university and they had all sorts of tours that we got to go on and show us the countryside and stay with families over there. So that gave me an idea of what to do when I got over there on my own, which is what I really had always wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
So that's where just going to Europe was like I was ready to go.
Cool.
You know, I had my savings, and it didn't take too much to run around over there. And this is a funny part of it, is that in Sacramento, there were gambling buses that would get boarded for free at a big mall area. So you could go over there, folks would drop me off, and I would get on one of those gambling buses and go to South Shore or North Shore, Tahoe, where all the casinos were. And I would go in there, and my brothers had taught me a little bit about the crap tables and blackjack and so forth, which I had never really done much of. But I took money. I would get my unemployment money, which was free, and I would take that on the bus up there, and I would gamble it on the crap tables. And I ended up making enough money there to buy a Eurail pass that covered, you know, any country, but basically all the countries you could go to. And so it was a priceless Eurail pass.
Awesome.
And so with that, I could get around all over Europe, basically, at the time. Berlin, the wall was still in Berlin, so I couldn't do certain things, but a lot of things were open. And then when I landed in London, that was hostel. I lived in hostels. That's where I stayed most of the time, was in hostels, and I had a hostel card. So when I got to London, I must have taken a bus or a taxi or whatever to the hostel, and I got in probably at night. And then I didn't have English money, so I had to figure out how to get English money. So I ran around in London and got a feel for that, got a place at the hostel. And from that point on, I just hitchhiked up and down Scotland and England. And that was really, really fun. The people were really sweet. It was very easy to hitchhike at that time. And then I hitchhiked. A Scottish couple was going up to see a grandpa up in northern Scotland. And they stopped and saw me, and they said, "You want to go up and go to Reverend Clark's house up in northern Scotland? That'll get you way up out of the British area."
Wow.
Sure. So they took me all the way up. And it happened to be that the Scottish minister, Presbyterian minister, had a wonderful multi-century-old home that he lived in. So if you were the pastor for the area, and the area would have been, as far as you could see, was your domain as a pastor. Those were the people that you served. And so one of the things was, every new pastor was to add something on to the home. And the church was a bit, not too far away, but the church was a little bit away. And so I got to stay in this multi-century, maybe from the 11th or 12th century home that had a dungeon. It had a dungeon in it, or they turned it into a dungeon throughout the centuries. And then the thing, it was used basically to have onions and potatoes and things like that stored there. It was cool and everything. That's what originally was set up for. But then it was turned into a dungeon, he told me. And the ceiling tapered down, so you'd go into it at maybe head high or shoulder high. Then it would get more and more narrow as you went into this thing. And you go, yeah, I think some of these cats back in the 12th century, you know, were taking this place as a place to store criminals or whatever. Anyway, that was very interesting. But the home was just fantastic, all stone, pretty high. And the man, Reverend Clark, was a very experienced and known archaeologist.
Oh, wow.
So he took me all over the area to show me the mansions and the stonework and where the Romans pathways were, and the roads for them, and the fences that were still up, the stone fences. And then the top, if that wasn't enough, and then he had a huge collection of all the things that he had found throughout his travels in Scotland and England, and which was just amazing stuff. He had a museum of his own, which he did open up to the public at times.
Cool.
And so he'd sit and talk about that. And then we got into World War II, and he said, yeah, I was a conscientious objector, so I turned into a spy that worked in France or around that area. He left England, and he went over as an underground, in the underground, wow, to send back information as to where German troops were and what was going on and so forth. And he had some just great stories about, here's a guy that lived it. He was there, and he said, I think he may have even stolen this thing. He was in a place, and the Germans had brought him into an office, and he stole, because he mentioned this in a story to me, that don't spit on the floor in German. And he could speak German. That's how he could get away with being a spy over there. And he could speak German. And he said, yeah, on the wall, when we walked in I was interrogated because they weren't sure what I was up to. And he said he couldn't believe it. There was a sign that says, don't spit on the floor in this room. And then he got interviewed. And I guess they let him go, and they didn't believe that he was a spy or anything, and he pulled it off well enough. And then I suppose he messed with the underground, the French underground, and then maybe it got too hot and he came back to London somehow. But he spent time over there being a patriot,
wow,
trying to, you know, battle the Germans, the Nazis. So that was another piece of that lucky pickup that I got from London up to northern
what
Scotland.
An education.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Just an, oh, and talk about romance. Yeah, and he had a daughter. He had a daughter that was there my age. And it was really fun to hang out with her, and slightly romantic. And then she wrote me to have a real Scottish family and a real Scottish young woman to be with. And then she wrote a poem for me about the heather in Scotland. I mean, who could give you a poem, a written poem from the heart of a woman that, you know, we were, you know, snuggling with or whatever. And I got to stay at that home, so we were all a family together. And then she was taken by me and me by her to a certain extent. And it came time for me to leave, and she wrote me this wonderful Scottish poem. Only a poet, you know, somebody that lived in the cold and the wind and everything up in Scotland.
Fun.
So anyway, so that was the romantic one piece of some romance that on that particular trip. But I wanted to go to Europe and see it all. Mm. Oh, and then my last name is Imsland, and I know that my grandfather comes from Norway. And so I went to the town that he came from, which was Imsland, which was above Stavanger, Norway. And I took a ferry up to a spot where I could finally, it's just a little tiny community right on a fjord. So there's not much access.
And this is like November, December. So it's like days are short. It's cold.
Yes, all that. I did everything in the winter. Everything was,
okay.
I had a tent, sleeping bag, cooking gear on me. I was pretty self-contained, and I could get stuck anywhere, which I was stuck up in Scotland before I got picked up, or when I was trying to get out of there. Cold winter, blowing, and but anyway, I kept all that gear so that I could survive wherever I got left.
Cool.
And back me up to re-grab where I was going.
Imsland, Norway.
Took
Norway, the ferry.
Thank you. Yeah, so I took the ferry over to Imsland, which they said when I got there, and people talked to me, and they said, yeah, they only make a trip, I think, 5-6 times a week, and they bring goods there. They might bring chickens, or they might bring grain or whatever. It's pretty rural.
Okay.
But anyway, I wanted to find out where my grandfather came from, which was basically the point when we get back to why'd you do this. But ultimately, the point of it was to do everything I said. But really, I wanted to see where my grandfather came from and if I could find out anything about my family history.
Yeah.
And so I went to the church there, which all the churches, anywhere I went in Europe, the churches were always open. So I figured I could always get in a church anywhere I was and sleep, throw my sleeping bag down, and nobody really cared over there. But here was another open Protestant church in Imsland in a graveyard. So I went and took pictures of all the headstones with the Imsland that had died and passed away there.
Huh.
And then this is the really, really amazing point, is that, so I'm by myself, and I walk down to the fjord everything is right on the water, so you're not going anywhere, really. So I walked down to the beach, and a boat shows up, and a couple of sons and an older man came out of the boat. They docked it, and I'm there with my backpack, and I've just walked down to the little village of Imsland from the main highway, which is nothing. It's practically a dirt road. But I walked down along a creek, got to Imsland, and I walked down to the sand at the shore. And this guy shows up with his family and a few fish, and they pulled the boat out of the water. And I watched all this, and then I went up to the older guy, and I showed him my passport, and he looked at it, and he kind of chuckled and laughed. And he says, "Oh, Imsland, Imsland." I said, "Yeah, my grandfather came from here, and I wondered if you know him." And his name was Jacob. And he goes, "Oh, I certainly do. Jacob and his brothers left in 1916 to go to America, and they never came back. Everybody stayed over. That whole family stayed over in America. And I remember him leaving, and that's what happened to Jacob." Here is a man that's
crazy.
He's like 75, 85 years old, and he could tell me more than any family member of that group. Nobody would have known what this fella knew about my grandfather and the brothers that all went over.
He says,
"Yeah, there were four brothers, and they all left, and there was a famine or something to that effect, and then they needed to go somewhere." So anyway, that was kind of the culmination for me of that trip, was that I satisfied an unbelievable, remarkable experience in the family community. And everything over there is like hasn't been moved in centuries and centuries. And that's the same with the town. Tiny little place, everything in stone, and just very down-to-earth people, just very simple. Just wonderfully simple farmers and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the rest of the trip was finishing out the rest of Europe, and the Oktoberfest in Germany was fun, in that main town. I can't think of the main town, not Berlin, but anyway, wherever they have the Oktoberfest.
There's everywhere. It could be Munich. It could be Hamburg.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah, it was Munich, actually, I went to.
Okay.
I went to the Hofbrauhauses and stuff there. And that was really fun. That was a real experience. Oh, God, you're bringing up all sorts of other things.
Cool.
And with all that, in Munich, I go, "God, I'm here. I should go to the concentration camps."
Oh.
They're somewhere around here. And so I went to Dachau, and I went on a bus. And I don't know if it was specifically designed to get tourists to Dachau, but it was, I doubt if it was, because when I got on, the German ladies that were in there saw me, an American, backpacking, and I sat down with everybody, and they all looked at me with that look of, you know, when they always say the Germans didn't know all this was going on. Well, you live next to Auschwitz, you live next to this, how could you not know?
Right.
And here I am, you know, leaving a big huge city, Munich, and I'm busing over to Dachau, and all these are local women going somewhere to a market or doing something, and here they looked at me like they were shamed, and they wouldn't really look at me like in the eyes or answer any questions or anything like that. So that was, and then I got dropped off at Dachau, thanked the bus driver, and walked through, which was very open. Dachau was not at all like, there's barbed wire probably still from the 40s.
Right.
There were machine gun towers still on all these corners, and I could walk anywhere I wanted. And there was a wonderful, sad monument with dead Jewish bodies in metal that was in there. And some of the bungalows that they put the prisoners in, or the Jewish people in, and waiting for the gas chamber, those were still existing. A lot of stuff was still there. And I was able to go into the where they gassed them and look at the showers and the gas lines into there. And it was just creepy. But, you know, it was real. I mean, I got to be there, which significantly wasn't past the war, so they hadn't really done too much.
I don't know, 15 years, no, sorry, 25 years later, yeah, 1970-ish,
yeah. you know? And so it was, I was really fortunate to be able to do that in such a, you know, yeah, go walk around. And then there was a museum there that had all sorts of pictures and the tattoos that the people were given and the clothing that they had and on and on and on. So everything was there. So you got a real taste. And then the machine gun or the gun towers were still there and barbed wire and all locked up, you know, everything, no escaping anywhere. So anyway, that was kind of the last thing. Other than I had written a friend in Sacramento that I had a French class with, and I wrote him, and I said, oh, it's great over here. And I didn't know it, but he got inspired and came over himself. And I'm in a London airport trying to get a ticket home, and I didn't have enough money. And this friend, by coincidence, shows up in the same little ticket-buying place in downtown London on an oddball street.
Oh, my gosh.
Never to find. And here I walk in, and they said, well, that British note isn't worth anything. That's old war money. And that's what I had been given from a shop somewhere.
Oh, wow.
In England.
Uh-huh.
And they said, no, that doesn't mean anything. Those are not pounds. That's from another era. And so I was stuck without enough. I had spent everything. I left there with nothing. And that was my last money. And then it turns out, I turned around and my friend was standing there in line. And I said, oh, man, I can't believe it. You came over. He says, yeah, I came over. And I did this and that. I said, well, I don't have enough money to buy the ticket to get home. Do you have any money? And he goes, yeah, I've got some money, and I can get rid of the pounds. And so he got me home. And here I was, you know, I had nothing. And here a guy came all the way over there from a note that I'd written him throughout my journey,
wow,
3 months through the thing.
Wow.
And there he was, bailed me out, sent me home. We sat together all the way, and we talked about our trip. And that's how I got home to Sacramento.
Amazing.
So that's what happened after the subway.
So that got you through to the spring of, this is probably 71, I'm thinking.
Yeah, you'd keep track of all those dates better than I will.
But it wouldn't be river season yet.
True. 71, probably not. Now, we're still in. Yeah, okay, you're good on your dates because in Paris I got a note. Western Union, that's where I got a lot of mail or notes when,
okay,
I was in odd places. And I went there, and Rob Elliott had written me and said, hey, I think we talked about this a little earlier, but he said, hey, would you like to, when you get back from your trip, how would you like to run another Selway trip? We want to advertise it, and what you'll do is you're going to run that trip, and then we're going to, before you do that, you're going to run two Middle Forks, and then... No, it's actually, when I got there, it was, you're going to run the Selway, and then you're going to come and do two Middle Fork trips, and then we're going to fly you and get you to the Grand Canyon, and you're going to start training on the Grand Canyon from that point on. That's when 72 happened.
Okay.
And so I got that message in Paris, and I thought about it, oh, my God, I'm all the way over
the
here.
The dreaded Selway.
Oh, Christ, I'm being asked to lead another Selway trip. And the boys had said, no, we're not doing this. And I felt the same way over there. I go, God, I don't want to commit to this. God. And, but I thought about it only for a little while, but I go, I'll do it, but under certain requirements. And I wrote him what the requirements were. And I said, I needed more boats. I needed more guides. And, we needed equipment that would hold up, whether that was new, if you could do it. But I wouldn't do it without more guides, more boats, and good equipment to go out. And these are the things that fell apart the first trip. And we can't go out there without good equipment and good boatmen that know what they're getting into. And actually, I don't think only one or two of the old crew did it, and myself. And so... I went over to do the Selway, and it was in flood, as high as it was before. And again, snow on the ground. And I'm going, oh, Christ, we're back in the same thing again. And so we sucked it up, and everybody got loaded up and all the gear, and off we went with my extra guides and extra boats.
And you would have known just by looking at the gear whether it was actually in better shape or not.
Oh, totally. I wouldn't have gone out without it.
Okay.
I had some very distinct requests that weren't going to be messed with. I wasn't going to do it. They can get somebody else. If they didn't follow what I said,
okay,
I wouldn't do it. Hell of them, you know. And so anyway, I got good equipment, good guides, and some of them had been down before, so that was a plus. And I think I had ordered in Europe, I had ordered a Les Jones map, and so I had something to go on when I got there. And that's when, on that trip, the Selway, at whatever that, I can't think of that name of that creek that we put in at, but the ranger station's right there. And they came down when we were halfway down, sort of halfway, a quarter of the way down. And he said, when you're done with this trip, on your map, are you noting what you're doing? And I go, yeah, I'm making notes on where all the runs were and where the campsites were and what to watch out for and blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, when you're done, could you give us a copy of that? So, because we don't know anything about this river and we're the rangers here. And he kind of went on and on how we don't know anything. And you know, they were dead blind on everything about river-wise. And this is also going back to the beginnings of river running, really.
Mm.
And so it wasn't surprising he didn't know. But all of a sudden, these people were showing up with rafts and running trips there. And there was no permits required or anything. It was just you show up and you went out. And that was also a beautiful period of time. I can't recall that the Middle Fork was official at that point, but I don't think so.
Don't think so.
And,
yeah, not in 71.
Yeah, no. And certainly not way up on the Selway, nothing. And they didn't know anything. So anyway, that was interesting. But so we headed out on our first day, and it seemed like every day we had a huge calamity. We wrapped a boat the very first day. This is all in flood. So we wrapped a boat the first day, and that was a huge, you know, difficult, swarming water, cold, everything was, it was just like the last thing you want to do is try and get a boat in that kind of hydraulics off of a rock that's fully wrapped and people getting people off and on the thing was it was just like, oh Christ, here we go.
Hmm.
You know, this is not easy. And so I believe every day we had some sort of an issue like that. Then finally we got down, and from the trip before.
So hang on a second. There's a boat on a rock. Don't leave it there. How did you get it out? What did you do?
So we got it out, and the people, I don't know if people got dumped off or they stayed on. I can't recollect how that worked or if they got picked up. If they got knocked out of the boat, they would have been so far gone. It was so fast.
Mm.
So I don't think that they got knocked out, but it was stuck on the rock. And so we figured the only way possible to do it was I needed to get out on that boat. And there was a boatman, somehow another fellow got out there. But I went upstream and jumped off, and of course with life jackets. I jumped off, and this is before wetsuits or anything. It was just cold snow water. Jumped off. And swam down as best as you could navigate how to hit that boat in the flowing water. And that's how I got on the boat to help out with getting the thing righted. And so I swam out and got on the boat, and the other fellow was there. And he was really good about, he was an engineer, this guide. And he said, you know, I think if we set up an oar and planted in the frame somehow, in the decking, and we have a rope from shore to that, we can get it tied, we can have an oar sticking up perpendicular to the floor of the boat or the decking of the boat.
Right.
And then we'll have a rope to shore, and it'll be the effect of winching up with the labor we've got on shore. We'll be able to lift that tube up off of the rope, off the rock, and the current will probably want to swing us around, and that's how we'll use that leverage to get the boat up and then off of that rock, and that's how it worked. It
okay.
was amazing. And
cool.
So that was pretty dramatic, and then everybody was happy, you know, the trip was moving forward, and then it seemed like every day, which I can't recollect except for my severe day, my rowing moments. But anyway, we went down and we knew Moose Creek was a place to camp. And so, and the ranger station was there at Moose Creek with an airport too.
Okay.
That was just, you know, rudimentary everything. But anyway, we knew when we hit Moose Creek Bridge that, okay, we need to get a campsite now. And we made a campsite and we said this will be a layover day. And we're going to spend all the next day walking down the river. Here it's all in flood and this and that's floating by and no boats are out there. We never see anybody. So we spent the whole next day walking the full length of all the rapids from Moose Creek through Ladle, because Selway's got a great trail along it. And so that was a real saving grace, is just to go on this well-hiked trail right by the water.
Hmm.
And we could stop and look at things. And since it was spring, there was waterfalls in the creeks and stuff. It was really beautiful, aside from the flooding river and what we had to do. But it was really fun to just be on shore and watch it and walk along it. And we were looking for where eddies were or any log jams were or what rapid looked horrible or how the run should go. And I made notes of all that stuff. And so then the time came to go back, hike back to our camp and have dinner and talk about what we saw and go out. We got away from the people. We just had a conversation about how we all felt and where our runs would be and how confident do you feel about what we can do. And, you know, be open, you know, tell me everything that you think is going on or could happen. And,
mm-hmm.
and did you look for eddies, you know, because eddies are going to be important because it's wall-to-wall water current. And so there were only a couple, but that was a good thing to note, that where an eddy could be, where you could pull a boat into or swim to. And so the next morning, it was sunny, and it wasn't rainy. I think it was rainy that prior night or something, but it wasn't. It was a sunny, warm day, and I'm always keen on having sunny days, whether it's warm or not, but I didn't like to run heavy stuff when it was rainy and cold.
Yeah.
It could be sunny and cold, but having the sun out just kind of cheered everything up. And said, okay, boats are loaded. We've topped everything off. Everybody's been checked. We know what we're going to do. And we may walk some stuff, blah, blah, blah. Big group guide and people conversation and give them a heads up of what we're about to go through. And so we pushed off. I led. And there were probably five or six boats because I'd asked for more boats and more guides. And so there was quite a string of us in case we lost boats, in case boatmen were hurt, anything. We needed manual help that knew what they were getting into.
Yeah.
And that's what we had, a solid team, really solid, plus the two or three that had done it before. So we push off, and I head on down to Double Drop. And Double Drop, I had remembered it from the prior year, and I'm pretty sure it was Double Drop, not S Turn, but went into Double Drop, and I approached it. It was a huge haystack, and I talked about ham rapid, but this was much bigger than ham. This was like going into a real sharp hermit rapid, but really, really sharp.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like a hermit where you flow down one wall and up the other wall. This was big drop. Drive up this downstream wall, hit the razorback at the top, and it was just like big drop up the wall, and I got smacked at the top by the rooster tail, and that pushed me sideways back down that wall and flipped me. And so here I am, lead boatman on this thing, and I've just flipped in the very first rapid with all day rapids yet to go. And, and we all knew what was below. The guides knew what was below. People didn't know. They just were like, you know, passengers doing
right.
this trip. And so I flipped, and the water was frickin' ice cold. And it was just shocking to go, wow, this couldn't be a worse place to have flipped on a trip that I'm in charge of. And I've just flipped and lost my boat. And the water was cold. And I think we cut it down to like maximum two or three people per boat max. And so I had two people swimming, me swimming, current fast, super cold, and I had held on to one of the women in her life jacket and held her and kind of scissor kicked to get to shore. And we were getting, you know, pushed downstream, and I was losing the eddy that we had, that we needed to get to, or else we were going to go down, right down through Estern and Ladle. And I don't think any of us would have survived that. We would have drowned. And so it got to the point that the stern line had wrapped around sort of my leg. I could feel it there. And I was untangling that, holding on to the woman. And I knew what was going on. We were getting farther and farther into all this. And I said, "See this eddy over here? You see where the creek side is? We've got to get to there into that eddy." And I hauled her as much as I could, and that was just enough to her to break into that eddy and make it before it spit her out at the bottom of that thing. So both women, well, one of them made it with that, and the other one, I think, kind of made it, but luckily Ken Jackson was behind me in his boat, saw what was going on, and he pulled over in our eddy and was able to grab that other woman. So we had both women. We had his boat, which, and everything was intact, and we all kind of got our bearings and rested for a bit and warmed up and talked about what we'd been through. And then since we had Ken with us and his boat and we could all fit, we rowed across before we, I don't know if we went to Estern, but we knew there was a spot above Ladle to pull into. And so we either pulled in before Estern or we went through Estern, and we let the people off. And they walked up to the trail, and I had Ken keep his boat there. We're going to walk everybody around Ladle. Everybody on the trip is going to walk this rapid. We're going to walk him as far as we need to walk these people around stuff. And that's what we're going to do until we get out of this 7-mile stretch.
And your boat is out of sight downstream, or did your boat make the eddy too?
No, my boat is flipped and over, and it's getting just beat to hell.
Okay.
And it went over some... And this is the one time that a Western trip was below us. And a friend of mine from KOA camp, Tim Nye, he ran for Western. And he happened to be out in front of us. And he saw our boat go by. And he says, "God, Scott, I saw your boat, whoever it was, went right over the top of Little Niagara." And we talked about that in last time, how frothy the water was and how tall Little Niagara Rock is. And he says, "Yeah, I watched your boat go over that. Never seen anything like it." And then it just kept on going, and we saw it coming, and he said, the Western guide said, and we talked about this before, the Western guide said, "Those California dudes, let that boat go. Don't go and get it. Tim, don't think about it. Let that boat go. They deserve it." And so we finally got to a campsite, and I was walking down the trail, which was thankfully there, and walked down the trail just to kind of see if I could find my boat or any gear that's left. And then Tim was walking up, figuring I'd be at a campsite by then, and I saw Tim on the trail, and he says, "Scott, the story I just told you, and I tied it off. It came, and it moored itself in an eddy, and I tied it off for you. It's a little bit banged up, and the stole pins are knocked off, but, yeah, it's pretty much all there." And so I got to go back to the Western group, but I wanted to get a hold of you to say that I tied it off, and that's the story of your boat. Well, thanks a lot. And so we rode down the next day, and there my boat was tied up. The whole top of it was ripped apart. So we made somehow we blocked it up with ammo cans or something to get my oars up high enough, and then we tied things off with ropes and so forth. So I was able to kind of get that boat down the river and to finish the trip. And after all of that, we were getting closer and closer to Wolf Creek Rapid after the flip and the rigging and the campsite and finding food. And I didn't have any clothes, and, you know, it was still cold and wet. But we could make campfires, and all the food was still on the trip. So we did that, and then we headed down, went through Wolf Creek again, and pulled out at the place we'd done the prior year. And again, congratulated everybody that we survived. We made it. And that was just another, it was the adventure that the first trip didn't have with the boat flipping. If the boat flipped on that first trip, man, that would have been it.
Right.
But this trip, we had good gear, And everybody knew what we were getting into and had seen it. And some were had experience now with it and knew what they were getting into, had volunteered to be on the trip. So we had a good crew that got us all down safely again. And then my promise of going to Grand Canyon was met. I did two more Middle Fork trips, and that was really fun. How blissful that was just to do a Middle Fork. And oh, it was just wonderful. It's like, oh man, this is so easy. This is just like gorgeous, man. This is like I was sent on a vacation to the Bahamas or something. So
hey,
I did
Scott,
those two trips.
I want to ask you, go back a minute. You mentioned your thole pins on your frame. Were you guys all running pins and clips, or was anybody doing open oarlocks?
Yeah. No open oarlocks. All pins, clips,
and
all that.
You know, pins and clips are easier because, you know, it keeps the oar blade perpendicular to the surface of the water, squared up and easy. But you get kind of gummed up when boats are right next to each other. You can kind of clunk and bump into each other, and you can't really use your oars at all. Was there any logic to that, or was it just simple, easy to do, this is what we use? I'm kind of just thinking about that history.
I don't think, like, we're talking about prehistoric times, rafting-wise, and the idea, I mean, thole pins have been around for eons. The Vikings probably used thole pins, and that's what we used, and or they put them in a notch and locked them down on a notch in a block or something like that. And anyway, the idea of oarlocks, no way would I have ever wanted anything like that. Now, I rode in the canyon, the dories I rode without, I rode just typical oarlocks. But I could see some advantage to those things, but not a great deal. I didn't see anything that bugged me about thole pins. They were... You could depend on them, and they would snap off when you hit a wall or you bumped into a boat or something like that.
Right.
They would pop off and get out of the way when it flies at you.
It's like funny because I'm just looking at you know, sort of researching river trips. Certainly looking at Grand Canyon, Dinosaur. The people that are running wooden boats and in rubber boats. Even going back to, you know, 1938 to Charlie, they're running oarlocks. And it looks like the pins and clips came in with the Dinosaur trips that Hatch was running in the 50s. And again, tons of guides didn't know a whole lot. This was a way to simplify oar operations without having to know how to use an open oarlock.
I think that's very true because it's simple, and you just throw it on and get out there. You know, on some water.
Yeah. When you guys were learning to row on the Stanislaus, was that what kind of oarlocks did you have?
On the Stan, we're all full pins.
Okay. Okay.
Totally. Nothing but. And I don't think anybody knew any different. That was just the way it was done.
Okay. Good to know. I'm just kind of putting that together in a timeline. Thank you.
Yeah, a timeline for sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like, to me, when I'd see somebody putting oarlocks on or doing, you know, this and that with that idea, I think it was probably, because all the dories, of course, had all that stuff, and then slowly the oarlocks came in onto the rafts, but I didn't think anything. All of my museum trips and all my commercial trips were all with thole pins. I would never, you know, it just gave you a more positive control of what was going on in some hectic situations. And it could still have the oars blown off of the thole pins, and they can get blown out of an oarlock. But it was a little bit comforting to have an oar in critical rock dodging and holes and all this stuff. It was better to, like, I'm not for artistic and, you know, historic conditions, put oarlocks on to look cool or do whatever. I'll keep the thole pins just so I don't have to mess with any of this stuff and getting my blade square and having it hit something hard and go through the bronze oarlocks and spring back and, Yeah, it never made sense to me. Practically, it never made sense to me.
Okay.
So, I had no interest. I mean, I would, on my my dories, it would look stupid to have bullpens. I would never do that. So when I rode the dories for Arda and Azra, I just, that was fine. I didn't mind it. I mean, the boat looks pretty enough, and I wouldn't want to screw it up with stupid old techniques and so forth.
Right. No. It's just interesting to look at that. Look at how that history was going, and when on the river did that really explode? And it happened there in the late 50s for that. So it's just fascinating to kind of put that together. Yeah, curious.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you threw something together that put a timeline on just the mechanics of what people went through to get a boat down that canyon.
Or
on a river.
Yeah, curious. Okay. All right, so two Middle Fork trips, and then you're sent to Grand Canyon. How did you get, this is in 71.
Yes.
And how did you get down to Arizona?
Okay, they gave me a flight, they sent a flight ticket, and before I left for that, I was, I had worked for, we all, being in Idaho, we all wanted to figure out a way to spend the fall there or maybe into the winter. And North Fork and Salmon, Idaho, all of Idaho is really keyed up to outfitting and hunting and all this kind of stuff. So we all kind of wanted to keep the thing going, the guide business in our hearts going. So I got... at the KOA campground, which was a staging area for a lot of the hunting guys to kind of get together. And the guy that ran the KOA was a wintertime hunting outfitter. And he said to me that this fellow named Tom that lives in North Fork, just above the KOA camp in Salmon, said, in North Fork, there's this guy and he's looking for somebody that can cook and, knows his way around the outdoors and so forth, and if you want, this is his address and blah blah blah. And so I met this guy and his family, and he said, I could really use you, and I've got an archery hunting group coming. And this guy was a big deal archer with records and trophies and stuff, and he knew his way around the Bighorn Crags up in Idaho. And we could go by the Bighorn Crags all the time on the Middle Fork, and we would see bighorns and the goats and all this stuff, bears. And so he says, I've got a hunting trip coming up next week, blah, blah, blah. And if you want, I'll hire you to help with the camp and the horses and on. Never saw a horse in my life. Mm. I said, yeah. So we got a bunch of horses basically from an auction that they would bring horses to these out-of-the-way towns and auction them off before they went to a slaughterhouse, I presume. Whatever. These were horses that were abandoned kind of by other people. So we went because he was really a cheap guy, and it was hard living there to make any money doing their business. So anyway, we went out with these ragtag group of horses.
What was Tom's last name? Do you remember?
God, that would be great, but Tom, no, that doesn't count. I can't think of what that guy's name was, last name.
All right, and typically horses at auctions, you might get one good one, but there's going to be a reason why those horses are in auction.
Absolutely.
Oh.
Terrible. So you've got these really abused and disoriented, and I haven't spent too much time around, no time at that time around horses. And so those were the horses that we took out. We loaded them up in a trailer of some nature. We took them to the trailhead that goes up into the Bighorn Crags, right along the Middle Fork. We were on the highway of going up alongside the Middle Fork, got to the trailhead, unloaded the horses and all the gear, packed them all up, and then headed out.
Did Tom help you pack? I mean, how did you learn how to figure out loads on horses on pack saddles?
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, I was an Eagle Scout, we had talked about, and I had done a lot of knot work and tying gear on the back of wooden frames, which was
okay.
The old style, you know? And so those were very similar
yeah.
to what you do on a horse. And so you'd use your same sort of diamond hitch to, my cat's out here. Hi, honey. There was just some of my stuff with the scouts and the the knot tying and the rigging up of this and that and odd situations, odd frames. So that helped with what I was doing.
Okay.
And
cool.
And so then everything was loaded. We had the people. It was only two guys and two of us. And we headed up the trail, and we putted along on our horses. And then we got to a place where Tom knew of a campsite, or we just picked one. But there was a creek in the way, and so we had to go down a hill, little bit of a hillside into the creek, then up the next other side. And it was all pretty fun as a kid that had never been on a horse before, and wrangling these things up out of creek beds. And not getting bucked off and making sure the horse worked with me. And so we got through the creek and up to a campsite and tied off all the horses, and I started dinner. And then the horses, like we'd said, were really a ragged group of horses, and they didn't like the idea that they were up and loaded and doing all this stuff. And it turned out that the Tom that was running this thing just beat those horses as much as he could to get them to submit to his what he needed him to, what he wanted, you know,
wow.
go somewhere and do this or whatever. And so here I'm not used to being around horses whatsoever, and he would take and find the biggest pine tree limb that he could just wail away on these horses that were wanting to buck and get out of there and leave and so forth. And so he just beat them, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And here I am in the middle of nowhere, and we're by, we haven't made it to the lake yet. So we finished the creek crossing and then up to campsite and did dinner, and he beat them all the time. And then the next morning, we all rigged the thing back up again and headed deeper into the Bighorn Crags to a lake, and that's where our next campsite was going to be. And he told me why we use the straw line rope that is on hay bales. And hay bales were wrapped and tightly with this sisal, it's the rope that's cheap, of course, but it does the job. And we used that to hook up all the horses in line on these small trails, almost cliff sides going down one side. And so it was very dangerous, really dangerous. You didn't want to be tied up tightly. The horses, you did not want them to be so tightly bound together in a line that if one fell, the line wouldn't break
right.
and let one go off the cliff and the rest of the
tick them off.
Crew stayed.
Yeah, you want to leave. So, you want one to go over, not the rest.
Exactly. And that made that was critical as far as some guy running this thing that I'm on, and he says, yeah, that makes sense because it's going to pull me over too.
Right.
And so that was that. And every once in a while, the horses get pissed off and they would buck at each other. And that's when the lines could snap initially. It was right there because they would not like somebody that close to their rear end.
Oh, got it.
Whatever. And so that was something we had to deal with. And you had to have the line between each horse long enough so they couldn't kick one another and still do the job. And so anyway, we did that until we got to our next camp. And the next camp was a lake, and you could fish there. I mean, this is in the middle of the wonderful Bighorn Crags and just unfound areas. People just, I guess they just don't go there, but it's magnificent.
Mm.
And the rocks are craggy. I mean, it's just high. Mm. Glacier cut rock is really pretty. So that's where we camped, and that's where they hunted out of. And my job was to get up at dark in the morning because they like to hunt with their bows early in the morning. And so I'd get up in the morning, start a fire, get the coffee going, start breakfast, make breakfast, blah, blah, blah. And then get, maybe make them a lunch or put out gear to have lunch. And then they would do that, and then they'd go off and hunt. And what I would do is watch the horses and feed the horses and walk the horses. So here we've got like four horses that hate me or hate him, hate man. And I had some cuffs that I could hobble the horses with so they couldn't like run away.
Right.
Or they could probably run a certain distance and then they'd whatever. But anyway, so that was really, really extreme for me to have four horses that once you untied them from a tree, if they understand, and they're smart,
right.
They could have made it all the way home, I would bet. They could make it all the way home from us up in these canyons. I'm sure they could have figured it out. They were, you know, they're not stupid.
Yeah.
They can be obnoxious and everything. So I had these horses that wanted to get the hell out of there, and I couldn't let them go. If I let them go, I was going to end up walking, and we have all this gear. And if I lost one, I'd probably lose more. And that would stick us all up in this mountain range just before winter's coming. And so it turns out that I would end up hobbling some of them and just really do like one at a time, hobble them, have a leash on them, and control them as best as I could. And actually had the nerve to let them graze, and then I found out that the grass that they were grazing on gave them gas from when Tom told me, he says, they shouldn't eat this, they should only eat this and that. Hell if I knew, I didn't know anything. And says you shouldn't let them graze. But the grass was gorgeous, so I figured, man, these guys will be happy having this grass. But anyway, that pretty much, that was us hunting, and they didn't kill anything. And
so they didn't get their, they didn't get their sheep.
Trophy.
Okay.
They didn't get their trophy, and I got to be around these guys as a group of men that I found despicable and disgusting. And it's kind of like the Trump kids going to Africa and shooting giraffes or whatever. Like these, all they wanted was trophies, and they couldn't. I think they would even, because Tom would go out with a rifle in case one was wounded and kill it. Because here you got guys that are archers that aren't that good anyway, and it's hard to be an archery guy and put a kill shot on.
You got to be super quiet, super good.
Oh, everything's got to be perfect, and it's not like you know, you're living in L.A. and you're going to, oh, that'd be a fun trip, Jack. Let's go do that. On and on. So anyway, I learned a lot about that kind of stuff, just being around all the scene and the guys. And then it comes up that they know that I just come off a river season and I just spent seven trips on the Middle Fork. And I said, oh, you know, I didn't think anything about it, but I said, oh, I saw all sorts of bighorns. My last trip was 2 weeks ago. And, yeah, they're all down, heading down towards the main salmon. But, yeah, there's plenty of bighorns. And that really set off the guide. I knew where the sheep were. He didn't. And I'm telling them, well, there's lots of them. You know, they're coming down for some reason out of wherever they'd like to hang. And yeah, that's quite a few. Well, how can we get to them? And that all got dumped on this guy. If there's any, getting back at somebody, it was right then when they are going, what are you doing? There's nothing here. We haven't found anything. And he's telling us there's...
They're all over there.
They're all over there. They're happy as little clams. And so that didn't go well. So we ended up pulling up stakes, tents, everything, and getting out of the canyons up there in the crags. And... packed out, and the horses were pissed off. They were exhausted, and I was burnt out with everybody there. That was such a weird experience, but it was great. I loved it, and it really it was helpful in a lot of ways. But then we just went home, crossed. I don't think we had to cross the river. We went back to the highway, and our vehicles, I hope, were still there. And we got our vehicles loaded up, all the horses, and. And they wanted, you got to find us a boat. We're gonna go. Can we go in the main salmon and float down that? And then we're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And this was way out of the league of Tom, you know, getting on a boat and trying to find sheep. So I left him at that point, pretty much. And I think the whole thing dissolved. And at that point, this gets to where I came to Grand Canyon, is that he dropped me off. He dropped me off at the a bus that came through Salmon, and I took that to with my plane ticket that Elliot had bought for me. So I had a flight, and I got a bus to Boise. I think it was Boise I went to, and flew in. Went there, flew, and then met a Mormon woman in the airport, and I told her what I was up to, and she goes, "Oh, why don't you come to my house, and I'll feed you, and I'll go and drop you off where you can hitchhike, and get to your next location." And so that worked out really wonderfully, and so we did that, and then I hitchhiked, and I managed to get to almost to the Hatch warehouse. I almost got that far hitching from up there. And then
This is the Hatch warehouse at Cliff Dwellers in Marble Canyon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Up from there. So I went in and I told them who I was and what I was doing, and I was going to start my first canyon trip. And can you tell me, where that's going to be? Where's Lee's Ferry? And da 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 da. So I can't say for sure, but I imagine that somebody in a truck or a car said, "Oh, we'll take you over to Lee's Ferry. What time does your trip start?" And you go, "Oh, it's going to start, this hour." And I believe, I can't recollect for sure, but I don't know if I met the crew at Lee's Ferry and we left from there, or I met everybody there and they dropped gear off and I went back to the warehouse up in by the peaks there. It's something park, all the housing out there in the flats. But anyway, we had a warehouse out there. So it was either I went eventually out to the warehouse and then back to the put in, or I just joined the group right then.
It's Arta in the day, the Arta warehouse. Arta. Would that have been in Flagstaff?
I was in Baderville at that time.
Baderville. Okay. Oh, right.
Yeah. That was where the motor rigs were done there, but also motor rigs also were out on Highway 85 heading north out of town. I think that's 85 going north. And for a while, I didn't work out of there.
89, but, right.
89. Yeah, so probably where all those fires went through, may have been where the old warehouse was.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, so I went to Baderville, and that's where the warehouse was and everything, and I helped rig up for the trip, and off we went. So
Scott, we've been going on for about an hour here, and maybe this is a perfect time to put a little comma in this interview series, and next time we will pick up with this Grand Canyon trip.
Yeah, that's a good time to do it, as I finally flown and hitched my way down to practically the put in and was just about to head out.
Okay. Very good. In this material that we've just covered today, is there anything else that you wanted to add or that I didn't ask you that I should have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. I'll just say, at that period of time that this story is all about was a real golden time, not only in my life, but just in all the guys, everybody that was similar age, similar interests. It was an opportunity in a very new moment of recreation, rafting. Everything was just the beginnings, and it was really fun to be with the guys and explore, not knowing where runs were. This goes to the Grand Canyon too, so when we pick it up, everything was new to everybody. Nobody knew anything, much like starting in the Selways. Nobody knew anything, and that's how the entire atmosphere of the climbing, hiking, rafting, everything was like, wow, this is great, and exploring, and everybody was on the same level playing field, learning and enjoying, and we were all a gang of friends and people. So it was just a great time that we've just talked about, just because everything was so undone before. It was really special. Great.
I want to ask you about that next time.
Sure.
Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part three of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Scott Imslin. Today is Monday, March 27th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it's been fun, Tom, and you brought me back many, many, many years into many, many experiences. And some of it brings back my
Hang on a second, Scott. Hang on.
Yeah, go ahead.